Welcome back, wonderful human being, to another episode of Conversations with Nova Reed. And now, the end is near, and so I face the final curtain. I'm sorry to break it to you, this is the penultimate episode, last episode next week, and I am... Don't be sad, because there'll be another season. I'll make sure of that. But as you know, I have to write a book. I can't do everything at once. I'm just one person. And I never imagined this season would go on for so long, that there are so many conversations with incredible humans I want to have in this world, and I want to bring them to you. So I look forward to being able to bring them to you in season two. As ever, a huge thank you to my Cool Cat patrons. You're awesome. Thank you for helping make this episode possible. If you're hearing about Patreon for the first time, it's this platform where you can donate like a cup of coffee. And in exchange, it sort of builds up a little kitty, and I use any donation towards helping me edit. This is a self-produced podcast, and it's really, really helpful in helping them remain sustainable and help me continue to churn out quality content for you. So if you'd like to see season two continue, then I would invite you to look at Patreon and see if that's a way that you want to support my work. So huge thank you. How have you been this week? I'm kind of in this writing cave, so I feel like I don't know what's happening. I mean, I do know what's happening in the world. How could you not know? But I'm definitely on social media less, and I notice that my mental health is better for it. And I noticed in the still of the night, a couple of nights ago, I wasn't sleeping. I have these moments where I have my head, literally, I have all of my, it's not very helpful. I have all of my best ideas, my best ideas about chapters, chapter directions, cover ideas at like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I have to write them down, otherwise I lose them, and then of course my mind is buzzing. And so I did what I probably shouldn't have done. I started scrolling through Instagram at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I saw one of my peers, a black woman who does some work, was recently interviewed on Good Morning Britain, and the amount of abuse and vitriol she received from speaking up against racism and supporting the movement of Black Lives Matter, the violence, the vitriol, the bile, the racism, and for everyone, I'm not racist, but type comments is just alive and kicking on Twitter. And it just takes me back to that stat from Amnesty International that reports that Black women receive 84% of the online abuse online. 84%. It begs the question, why aren't social media companies doing more to protect black people, black women, online? And I'm not saying that online spaces should be free from debate or people who hold opposing views to you. That's not what I'm saying. But there is a difference between having an opinion and free speech and inciting racial hatred. I don't know why the lines are so blurred. It's very clear and very simple. I'll give you an example. So I'm trying to verify my social media account. And I have to submit a form of my identity to confirm that I am who I say I am. So photo ID. I would be very happy doing that as a social media user if that means that people's identity can be revealed, and that these bots and these people who are scared and you know almighty behind the comfort of their keypad with an image of a cartoon character, so that they can hurl their abuse. But actually, if you have to reveal your identity, that it would make it much easier to deal with these kinds of ongoing cases of abuse. I would be very happy to do that if it meant that more people like me were safe online. And so it does beg the question, why aren't social media companies prioritizing this? And I wonder if it would be prioritized if the demographic that was receiving 84% of the abuse were white women or white men. Ponder, question, there we go. Right, today's episode, I am joined by a student on my anti-racism course, who is also an educational psychologist called Nasia Lane, and she is just completely embodying this work with full gusto. We talk about everything in this, from how she came to sort of start this journey, being in an interracial relationship, working in education, being a parent, and just being a human. And we really dive into this question, and I think it was Robin DiAngelo that sort of framed this question, like, on becoming anti-racist, on being an ally, the question I am asked over and over again is, how can I be a better ally? What can I do? How can I be a good ally? Now you can see why I chose that book title. Well, one of the reasons. What can I do? What can I do to help? And that question was the question I got asked time and time again over the first 2 weeks of this awakening, instigated by George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and all of those who sort of came before. And the question that Robin DiAngelo posed, I'm sure it was her that framed it, is like, the question to ask, particularly for white people and people who hold white privilege, is how have you come to not know what to do? How have you come not to know how to help? In the age of information, where it's available at our fingertips online, how have you come to not know? And that, to me, I think is quite profound. And Natalie and I discussed this, along with the importance of being intentional in your anti-racism work, and what happens when we are intentional. We dive into a whole lot. I am going to stop talking. Enjoy and listen, be challenged, be moved, and let us know what you think. Welcome to another episode of Conversations with Nova Reed. Today, I am joined by another wonderful human being, Natalie Elaine, who is an educational psychologist and is one of my anti-racism students. And before we dive in to your anti-racism journey, Natalie, I'm not letting you off the hook. Who are you beyond your roles?
So beyond my role as an educational psychologist, I am a wife and mother. To two gorgeous children, and I'm somebody who feels things very deeply and is an empath. So I can really connect with people and their situations, and sometimes that can be a blessing and a curse, especially if I don't boundary that well enough, because I want to be there for people. I want to help people, and if I hear that somebody's got a need or a dilemma or something, I'm tend to be the one I'm automatically thinking, well, what can I do to help? And I want to just make that better and make the world a better place so that everything can flourish and people can go on to live their best lives. So yeah, I feel things very deeply. I'm a very active person. I'm a runner, I'm a dancer. I tend to do my best thinking and my best learning. I always listen to your podcast when I'm running, when I'm moving. And you make me cry sometimes, and you're not allowed to make me cry when I'm running, because that's hard to do. I'm somebody who loves to laugh, and I like banter, I like humour when it's safe, obviously. And I can really sort of see the funny side in things. Try very hard to see the positive all the time. People tend to come to me and say, you know, oh, I'll come to you because you always find the positive, and I do. I do try and strive for that, but yeah, sometimes that can be
hard. Yeah. We just have to sit in the reality of the ickiness.
Yeah, so I think that's a bit about who I am. Yeah,
thank you. And I just want to pick up on the empath piece, because I do think it's, you know, in order for you to be in a therapeutic role or to do the work that you do, like, you have to have empathy.
Yeah.
So it's kind of our kryptonite, isn't it? It's what makes us great at, you know, caring for others.
Yeah.
But also can, you know, mean we absorb it. So that really resonated with me. And just before we get into our conversation about your own anti-racism journey, because I know we've got a lot to say, where did you grow up?
I grew up just sort of on the border of Sheffield, so South Yorkshire and Derbyshire. And yes, I think I grew up in a predominantly, if not exclusively, white environment. And certainly until I think I was coming towards secondary school, before I met anybody that was black or brown, I'm sort of reflecting back. And then even then, when I met those people, I could name every single one of them because there were so few. Very exclusively white. Grew up in a quite an unusual situation in the fact that I grew up in a group of seven families, that we were so close. There was almost like honorary mums and dads, if you like. Everyone was in and out of each other's houses and spending holidays together and celebrations and things like that. And in actual fact, all those parents are still together as a group as well. Wow. That's remained to this day. That's a little bit about where I grew up, how I grew up.
And do you think, you know, growing up somewhere where you were exclusively white, was there a moment when you started to be more conscious of your race, or to start to notice other people being different to you that stands out?
I don't think there was a defining moment when I thought I am white.
Surprised.
Kel to freeze. But I do remember when I was about six or seven, I was walking on a beach with my grandparents and family. It was really important to my nan to get a tan. That was something that she really liked to do, and she liked to see us get a tan and what have you. And we were walking down this beach, and she pointed to two people that were laying sunbathing. And like I say, my memory now, I can think back that they would have been black or brown people laying on the beach. And she said, would you like to be as dark as them? And I remember looking at them and saying, yeah, I would. And kind of in that moment, it was born that belief that's how black and brown people came to be. They were just people that had stayed in the sun longer than I had, which is sounds awful, and it's crazy, but it's amazing as a child what's planted, isn't it, and what grows. Yes. And what becomes something that she probably thought was a throwaway comment, but it became something. So I started to believe that black and brown people were the same as me underneath their clothes. It was only the parts of the skin that had been bathed in the sun that had gone darker. And that probably, I don't think that particularly forefront thought in my mind all the time, but that will have stayed with me for a while, I think.
I mean, the fact that, you know, that memory has stayed with you shows how significant it was.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I often get people coming to me asking, you know, I don't know how to talk to my child about race, and, oh, well, they're too young. And like, we already notice. Children are very wise. Yeah. They notice when you start treating people differently, or they notice when you're not filling in the gaps.
Absolutely.
And then they can form their own story. So it's really important. Children are given the opportunity to be curious.
Yeah.
When did you start your anti-racism journey? What was the catalyst for you?
This is a bit I don't quite understand where it first came from, because, as I've said, my background, my upbringing probably wasn't even predominantly white. You could almost say exclusively white.
Yeah.
But I did develop this sense of this strength of feeling and this understanding about the injustice and the discrimination. And despite the fact that I wasn't surrounded by anybody else that thought this way, I think I connected, although I wouldn't have known it at the time, to I think I saw the trauma in it. I wouldn't have named it that, but it was such a strong feeling, because, again, it's another memory where I would go to sleep at night. I remember going to sleep at night and crying and wishing I didn't see it. I wished it would be taken away from me. I'd wish that I could see things the way that all the other people around me saw things. I really didn't want to think and feel like this anymore, because it was getting me into arguments and difficult confrontations, and I think that's where it started. But then I got into quite a really horrible situation. It silenced me, and then I didn't speak up. I knew it was wrong. I just knew it was wrong. And I didn't have the strength, the confidence, the words, the language, anything at that point. So I'm going back now, I'm talking around 14 years old at this point. I gradually, over the next few years, I guess, started to mix with more people from different backgrounds. Around 14, I became really close friends with a girl that was Indian. And so I guess I went into a kind of listening mode. So I'd and then later at university, in groups, there was more of a mix. I remember listening a lot to what other people were saying, black, brown and white people that were talking from a very knowledgeable perspective about racism. And I'd just listen and take it in, still continuing to have these arguments in my head from way back when I first tried to speak out and then was silenced. I would argue it all the time. I mean, like, these conversations weren't even happening anymore. These people weren't even that much of an influence anymore, but I wasn't able to let that go. And I was a teacher, a secondary school PE and dance teacher before I became an educational psychologist. It's part of the journey to become a psychologist at that time was to be a teacher. But this teacher that I met, she was in charge of drama and I did the dance, and obviously we worked on performances together. She was a white lady. She had a black husband. She had the first person I really met with a knowledgeable intellectual. She was giving me a bit more language around it. And I listened to her a lot. And by that point, I was starting to speak out more in my own world.
It was always, you know, you were always, it sounds like you were always conscious. So from a young teenager, you were already seeing things that weren't making sense to you, and just didn't, even if you didn't know why, you didn't have the context or the language, you knew that they were inherently wrong, what you were experiencing in terms of some form of racism. And so I guess my question is, did you take anti-racism work on in a more conscious way when you started having a relationship with a black man, or was it forced upon you?
By this point, I'd not met Rob. Because we've not said that, have we, that I'm white and my husband's black. I've got two children that are dual heritage. So this was prior to then. So then when I met Rob, we definitely had conversations really in the early part, because I remember sort of thinking at one point, I almost felt as if he was testing me out to see, you know, and I can remember this one, we were talking about different things. We was in a conversation about me speaking out. Then, that's just come to me. So it was somebody that I worked with, that a white lady who was from South Africa, and she had some very strong, difficult attitudes. She said, "Oh, I hate black people with attitude." And I said, "Well, what about white people with attitude?" And she said, "Well, I hate them as well." And I said, "So you hate people with attitude? So that's the problem." And she said, "Oh yeah, when black people, they get to the front of the counter of a bank, and then they put the sign up that says it's closed, and they just say, 'Oh, you've only done that because I'm black.'" And I said, "Yeah, but you don't know how many times that's happened before, or how many other things have happened in the run-up to that. That might have been the final thing that day that was like, you know, this has happened again. So they've had enough." And in that conversation, Rob sort of said, oh, there's not much wrong with you then, is there? And I kind of felt as if I'd passed a bit. Not that he was testing me, but it was kind of that he was like, okay. There was a boy that I was teaching who referred to himself as coloured. And I said to him, "Don't ever accept that. Don't accept that as a phrase." I mean, I don't know whether I worded it well at the time. And we had a conversation around that. So it was not letting things like that go. We were there. I was there at the time when 9/11 happened, and there was a young girl who was treated horrifically. I felt in the class that I was covering at the time, and she walked out, and I got very, very cross at the class, went after the girl, spoke to her, said, I hear you, it's not your fault, it's not your fault. You know, she was really in a terrible state, and took it to the senior leaders and wouldn't have allowed that kind of thing to have just happened in my classroom without confronting it. But then at the same time, I don't get it all right as well, because I also remember in those early days that I, because of what I thought was right, I was referring to people of dual heritage as half caste, and he pulled me up on that. He said, I don't like that, it's mixed race. And I was like, right, okay, that's it, that's fine, please let me know if there's anything else, kind of thing. And so we were having these conversations quite early on, and we've always had, you know, we've had things that have happened along the way, or we've not taken it as seriously as I have done in now. But it's stages. Like, so when I went then on to train as a psychologist, I wanted to look into systemic racism in education. And it was a very much a kind of academic approach that I took. So I was working in Leeds at the time. We did a massive project, and I was picking up we did a massive project with young people that were in pupil referral units. So a pupil referral unit is when it's like a support centre for children that are on the verge of exclusion or potentially will get permanently excluded. Mm. So they kind of spend some time in the whole time in the pupil referral unit, or they have half time in mainstream. And the idea is that they only go there for a certain amount of time, they get a bit more of a nurturing education, and then they're reintegrated back into secondary school. So it was secondary school where I was working, so 11 to 16 year olds. We were trying to look at, you know, what we could do to try and reduce the numbers that are going in, help, you know, keep them included in school and that kind of thing. And I was going through some of the interviews, and I noticed some language that was being used. So I noticed that sometimes the young people were referred to as gangs of youths, and other times they were referred to as groups of young people. So I took it then to the leader, and I said, I am interested to know whether the gangs of youths are black and brown and the groups of young people are white. And at first he was a bit like, I got a bit of a kind of, oh, she's here again talking about that. But actually, when we went back, I was absolutely right. On every single occasion. And so I developed this training. I got very inspired by Neil Thompson's His Elegant Challenging, and that's become a massive part of how I manage challenge, I guess. I've used those methods. But it was from a very much an academic point of view. And I think, so it's always been part of our conversation, not in the depth that it is now. It's very, very different now. I took this training to Derbyshire when I came to and started to work there. Derbyshire said, we don't need it here.
We're already great.
And they sort of signed. And I ended up doing work with the traveller community on it instead. And then I put it down, and I felt okay, you know, that's not wanted here. And then a few years ago, we were putting on a conference at work about vulnerable kids. And I noticed that within the workshops, no one had brought up race. So I asked why that was. And then really, I think that I was really ignited at that point to bring this research and this training and things that I'd sort of put together back to the fore. And my principal was really keen for me to do that. I didn't have enough time before the conference to do it. So then I was again going about it in this very academic way. So I was looking at the statistics again, and I was looking at research. I was looking at what was happening. I was particularly interested in, because I can't relocate this, that it was a study that I found when I was in Leeds, where it was saying that some of the worst racism that's happening in schools is from young white females to the black pupils, and often to the black males. And I wish I could locate that again, because I'd love to know more about that.
I mean, you don't need to locate it. It's historically a theme.
And I've listened to you. And this is where then I lead to. This is where the change comes, is I'm researching. I'm doing it, you know, in amongst what I can. And then I stumble upon you on Instagram via a really unusual route. But I stumbled upon a lady called that has an Instagram page, a white lady, and she was talking about racism. And I was like, yes, yes. And then somehow she linked to you. I don't know, but then I came across you, and then everything changed. Everything changed. It moved from the cognitive, academic, even performative allyship, you might say, into something so much more. And you gave me language and knowledge, and it all started to make sense. And then within that, because then obviously I came to your supper club last summer, within that, I felt my calling. I feel like it's a calling to speak to my people, my white people, and implore them to take on this work. I'm not pointing the finger. I'm never, like Laurie Hutchinson says, no one's mad at you for being white. It's a bigger picture than that. I'm imploring you to do the work. And not only that, when I was in, it was like a sucker punch when I was in your supper club, and I was stood by the window, and I was nervous anyway, because I'm nervous when I talk in groups, and I already out of my comfort zone, but it was so important to me to be there. You were talking about things, and it brought it to my family, and it brought it to my friends, who I am very blessed to have many friends, and many friends from black and brown background as well. And I started to think about my relationships with them, my relationships with my sisters-in-law, my family, my husband, my children. And it was like, oh, wow. This is bigger. This is deeper. This is the most important piece of self-development work anyone can ever do. But for somebody that is an interracial relationship, it is the piece of work you need to do. And I'm still not there. And I don't believe I ever will. I don't buy into the good person, bad person thing. I think we're a work in progress, and we are on a journey, and I strive to do the best that I can. And believe me, it is with me all the time. It never goes. And I've said that before, but it's, so I'm not there. There are still layers. There's things that I read and I think, all right. And this is the other important bit, is I'm also reading through my white gaze. So it's important that, and this is that, and I say to other people as well, it's all very well me imploring people to do this work, but then I've got to move them on to the people with the authentic experience, to the people with the knowledge about anti-racism.
I just want to bring it back and just express this again, because I think it's really important that people let this land. When you said doing this work is the most important piece of self-development a person can do who is in an interracial relationship, I just want to let that land, because so often in this work, people who are dating somebody who is black or brown and they are white or who hold white privilege, they don't think they need to do the work because, well, I clearly don't need to do anti-racism work. I'm clearly not racist. I'm married, partnered, dating a black guy. And one of the most violent experiences of racism, gaslighting, tone policing, whataboutism, deflection, denial, belligerence, white fragility, and all of its in its ugliest forms, I have seen come from a white man who is married to a black woman and has mixed race children, because he does not believe he needs to do this work. He thinks he's an exception to the rule. So I just wanted to shine a spotlight on that as well. And I wonder if, you know, and I know language has changed and the landscape is evolving, but was there ever a time where you wouldn't have even thought you needed to do this work?
The work as it presents now from you and Rennie and Layla, I wouldn't have known existed. So yeah, I wouldn't have, would I have known to think to do it? No, because as soon as I knew it existed, I wanted to do it. So I'm not sure.
I think you've answered that. It because you didn't know, as soon as you knew, that it existed, then you wanted to do it. There wasn't this, well, I don't need to do that. I'm not what, that's for those
people. Yeah, and other people have put that on me, actually, because I remember very early in my relationship with Rob, somebody saying, oh, well, no one could call you racist. And I actually said, well, actually, they could. I could be the worst kind of racist going. And then when I was travelling down to the supper club, I'd put a post on Facebook to sort of say that I was going. And somebody came on and said, are you sure you need that? And I was like, yes, I do.
Oh, yes.
And everybody does, actually. So there was some kind of understanding there, although I didn't have all this language that I do now. I think the depth of my conversations with Rob now are different. We've even talked about and laughed about, you know, different things that we've had along the way. And now it's like it's given him the language. He's wanting to read Layla's book, and he's having different conversations with his black friends now, and he's saying, you know, it's microaggressions. That's what you need to look up about my, and those, that kind of language is now, and it's opening us up to a different depth in our relationship. And I am having to face that I haven't seen it, and I am mortified about that in some ways. What I do remember is a defining moment when I knew that my whiteness was power, and that was only a few years ago. And we were at a in fact, I would even go to the point now, having got further language, in saying that knowing that my whiteness can be weaponized against somebody. And we were at a wedding in up north. And we got into an argument, unfortunately, me and Rob. Just an argument between man and wife, husband and wife. Sorry, that sounds really sexist. It happens. We decided to take it out of, you know, so we didn't cause a scene. So we went outside, and it was on a main road, this really busy road, but it was a residential road as well. And we were having this argument, and we can only assume that somebody called the police, because the police turned up. And in that moment, even I was so angry with Rob, I suddenly felt so protective towards him and thought, he's in danger here. This situation is very vulnerable. But that's what I do reflect on that moment, because I think that is why whiteness is the ultimate power in all the, you know, when you look across discrimination. What you can do with your whiteness is, if you were that way inclined, is absolutely horrific. And I know that you've said this as well. It should be in with abuse and trauma. The enormity of that is mind blowing. Really, I mean, obviously, clearly, I would never do anything like that. But I realised.
But you realised in
could.
That moment that you, yeah,
and
yeah, and that, I mean. Thank you for sharing that, because I think it's, you know, we're seeing it with the kind of Amy Coopers of the world, with the Carolyn Bryants, and these historical moments where white women have consciously known that that they can manipulate an outcome that could end up with loss of life or some kind of retribution to that person who is black, mostly black men. And I think, you know, recognising that is really important, and for some people quite painful. You mentioned that you and Rob have now been able to go to this depth in your relationship, and I hope it's okay to say this, that you sometimes, you know, as part of doing this, going on this journey together, you will sometimes ask each other, how is white supremacy showing up in our relationship? I mean, how incredible to have those conversations. So you mentioned that your relationship had gone to this depth, and that you're mortified that you hadn't seen it. Can you just expand on that a bit more? Are you mortified because you haven't realised the full range, the depth of range of your relationship?
I think there's that. And I think I ignored I've not focused enough on the enormity of what his experience has been. And I've known about, you know, certainly overt acts of racism that have happened towards him, but not really given enough, impetus or whatever it is, towards the or every single day thing. I mean, we've laughed. Yeah. Like I say, we've laughed when he said, you know, oh, you know, people have turned up and said, oh, you didn't sound black on the phone. And we got a laugh at that. But actually, it's another paper cut. It's, and these, you know, these things are impacting him all the time. And the rest of my family really as well. And so sort of thinking about them as well, of what haven't I seen? What haven't I seen, what haven't I known? What, you know, when I was thinking that I was being anti-racist and being, you know, where have I tripped up? I did ask this actually of a friend, because I've got one friend who would go quite deep into racism. And in fact, she was the inspiration behind that sentence that I wrote to you in the email, the boundary between being a good ally and stealing the mic. And it was in this conversation. Yeah. It was just before I did the training that, you know, I did presenting the research and at my work in February. And I wanted to go through it all with her. And just because some of my black friends, they don't want to talk about it, you know, or aren't interested. Because just because you're black doesn't mean to say you have to have an interest in race, do you? But she is. She is open to it. And we can have some really great conversations. And so I said to her, where have I tripped up? Is there anything that I've done? And she was like, oh gosh, Nat, you know, you're asking me, I don't know. And I was like, no, honestly. And she said, her and her husband, because I'm also involved in sort of moving the anti-racism thing forward in my church. So I'd been talking to my pastor, who's very keen to do that, another big, big area. And she'd been talking to her husband and said, oh, you know, when is Natalie going to I don't know whether she used the term pass the mic, but basically give the platform back to the black people in church. And fortunately, I was able to say, oh, I have said that already. But it really got me thinking, because I thought, yes, I'm very passionate about this work. I'm very conscious, I'm very aware when I'm in the field, when I'm in my work and I'm talking about this in work and saying that, to say I am a white woman speaking on this. But where is that gap? Where is that that boundary between being a good ally and stealing the mic?
Yeah, it's all of that. It's all of that. It's being, where's the fine line between being a good ally and becoming a savior? Yes. That's the fine line. And I think again, this work, it requires us to be so self-aware. Because it's not that you're speaking on our behalf, it's that you're walking alongside us, you're talking alongside us, and also you're recognizing that unfortunately we are in a system where we're all participating in white supremacy at the moment. We can't avoid that. It's a system with which we're in, and until it's completely dismantled, we are all participating in it. As part of that consciousness, it means you're also able to recognize where you hold more power or influence simply because of the colour of your skin. And there's been, I was sharing with a colleague recently who also teaches anti-racism, and he was sharing, I'm not sure where your podcast episodes will land, but he was sharing about teaching an anti-racism workshop where he just got completely attacked by a white woman who was very offended that they even had to have this workshop, that they didn't need it, that he was the troublemaker, and that he was bringing up things in the past and that it should stay in the past and basically just go away and leave us alone and stop making out like we're the bad ones. And so that, you know, microaggression after microaggression after microaggression, when you're a trainer and you're a black man and you're in a position of authority because you're teaching, it's really difficult to navigate. And he said that there was a moment where he just needed to pause, because if he didn't pause, he would react. He could also feel that he was activated. And so in that moment of pause, another person in the room who was white spoke and said, well, actually, there are, you know, these things do happen now. And then he was able to recall and give some examples. My colleague, who's a black man, was very grateful to that intervention in that moment, because he realised, one, he was there on his own and he didn't have any support. And two, he knew in that moment with that person so activated and so offended by the fact that a black person is teaching them about anti-racism, that she would only have the capacity to listen to another white person. So I feel like that's where you're coming from, where you just felt there was a calling for you to, I can't find it, to speak to your people. There's that piece of work that needs to happen alongside and addition to, you know, the raising of voices, the handing back. Well, actually, is there a mismatch here? Do we need to be hearing from me right now? Do I need to be bringing in experts and getting them paid and fairly compensated to do this work? And I think that's always, you know, sometimes you might get it wrong.
Yeah.
But I think that's part of the journey, isn't it?
I know. And I will get it wrong, and I do get it wrong. And I do reflect on it. I think that is... this kind of this standing in the gap bit of being between the people that are harmed by the system and the system itself, so that you can speak out. Somebody who has recently connected me to, because it is kind of exploding at work at the minute, the amount that I'm doing on this area, it's really gone crazy. And a black psychologist, male psychologist from London, contacted me, and we had a bit of a exchange about it. And he said, because I said, and I said this about the boundary between good ally and stealing the mic. And he said, when you become aware of the fact that you're holding the mic, it's time to speak up. And he was sort of encouraged me to speak up, and keep speaking up and keep saying it and keep doing it. So he was sort of a great encourager there. But the way I'd been thinking about it was that kind of, the standing in the gap between the system, the people that are being harmed, because sometimes some of the things that I'm that people might talk to me about, they are microaggressions. And I think, well, if I could sort of work with somebody on those first before they go, because... sometimes, I mean, Rob will be the spokesperson for in his, you know, people will come to him and almost expect him to be the spokesperson for black people, if you like. And as a consequence, he's hearing a lot of things that to hurt him. So they like kind of go to him to almost like, well, what do you think? And I think a lot of the time they're expecting him not to have an opinion or to assimilate to something else.
But also, I mean, that question in itself is so problematic, because again, what's been missed is you know, the fact that racism is a form of trauma. And if we're thinking like in the moment right now, with this, you know, the galvanising behind anti-racism, the resurge of Black Lives, I mean, Black Lives Matter has always been there, but this sudden new energy behind it, and everything that's happened with not just George Floyd, but Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, Belly here in the UK, black trans people who've been murdered. I can't remember all the names. I don't want to be disrespectful, but there's been this sequence of so much death and abuse on black bodies, all in a short period of time. And then on top of that, for a colleague or a peer or whatever it might be to then go and ask your husband what he thinks about it, you're asking him to reconnect with trauma.
Yeah, and that,
especially now, it's not entertaining.
And that's what I said to a colleague who'd come forward to ask me about, because she was saying about a friend of hers that's black, and how she would sort of saying how she approached these things at court. And I was saying, you know, just be careful. I said, say for example, if there was a massive CSC, child sexual exploitation, in the community, in the press, it was all over. Would you go to somebody that you know has had that experience in their background to ask, why do you think they did it? Or what, you wouldn't do it.
It would never.
Similarly, on the flip side of that, if there is something big happening, like, and again, an analogy might be, if something massive was happening in your parents' hometown, where there was a spate of burglaries, maybe there was some flooding, something massive, didn't necessarily impact your parents, but your friend knew that they were there. So would your friend ask you about your parents? Yes, they would. So similarly, if there's something big happening, ask your friend how she's doing, because it's likely to have an impact. Yeah. So there's a difference. I said, but be careful before you go to her just do a bit more of the reading. I sent, you know, your podcast. I usually say your podcast, Rennie's book, Layla's book. Do a bit of that first before you go in, because just in case, because I was fielding some microaggressions and I didn't want it to go that. So I don't know whether that's a protective stance. I don't know whether that's a good place, a good way to manage it or not. But I just thought if she could have some more thinking around it before she sort of went in with anything that might harm.
And so I don't know about you with your psychologist hat on, but I, in the work that I do, the more I'm doing this work, the more I see the same patterns of behaviour. And especially now where there's this sort of this awakening with so many white people who are just waking up for the first time, that actually, wow, this is a problem. And, you know, how can I help in some way? And what I witness is what I would describe as a real emotional immaturity with having these cross-racial conversations, an inability to think for oneself, difficulty using initiative. So like it's like there is something childlike almost. Tell me what to do. Tell me what to do. When, of course, all of this information, it is overwhelming. I'm not denying that. But you can Google.
Yes.
You can literally Google and start that process of reading. But it's like there's a disconnect. Yeah. There's this cognitive dissonance and it doesn't happen. And I find it really fascinating because that's not present in other circumstances. No. So what is it about racism that triggers this?
I know. I don't know, because I said a similar sort of answer to somebody else recently. Said, well, I don't know what to do. I said, we don't know what to do because some people like this or some people like that. And I said, but we live in an age of information. Ignorance is a choice now. So go and, you know, and this is, you know, I'm putting out, that, like I say, that's what I normally say is your podcast, Renee's book, Layla's book. Follow these people and list, you know, and go and do the research and do the reading and, but do the work. Don't do it as a, I don't want to say jump on the bandwagon. Don't do it because you want to do a bit for the cause. Do it because you need to work on yourself and you need to do it for the good of something that's so beyond you. It's not for you. And that's why I think it's such an important piece, the most important piece of work.
I mean, you know, you're talking to the converted here, and that's how I approach this, Natalie. I'm like, this isn't, especially in this movement, people will come to this work because they want to be an ally. They want to be one of the good ones. And then they realise, then there's this unravelling. Then there's, whoa, okay, this isn't just about, you know, doing some good tasks.
Yeah.
This is about me as a human being being the best, you know, being a better human being and also serving humanity and a cause that's bigger than me. Yeah. And there are people, again, you mentioned it earlier, I have two types of people on this on my anti-racism course or who come to me in my work in whatever, you know, offerings I have. And they're those who are getting it cognitively and can reel off all the stats and the information and the words and the language. They haven't connected with it in their body. They've not connected. They are disconnected. Those who get it in their body, you become
absolutely
the work.
You absolutely do. And
you don't have to fit it in. It just is.
And I've seen that in other people as well. My pastor in particular who picked up this word, and now he says, I can't unsee it. I see it everywhere. I can't stop seeing it. And I was like, yeah. It's like... somebody else told me it was like they sent me this clip of from the Matrix, you know, when he's given the red pill to take, and you see, and it's like clarity. Once you take this pill, you will not stop seeing it, and it's always been there. But you're gonna, and I was like, gosh, yeah, that's what
I say. Be prepared to, you know, for those who are wanting to go on this journey, I say be prepared to change to have your life change, because it will change you. And there will be some things that you let pass by that you won't let pass by anymore. And that might mean having to let go of certain relationships, which is really, and some of those relationships are intimate ones. So this isn't, I'm not playing around, like, this isn't a joke.
And
this,
yeah, this and that's real. Why, you know, I've still got a way, you know, like I say, it's a life journey, so I've still got a long way to go. And I would, like I say, when I was working through, say, Layla's book, and I was thinking, you know, you're doing the work and you're going in depth, but really it's all through my white gaze. So like being on your course is more because you're lead. You're going to have a different perspective and listening and talking, yeah, like say my friend who is open to these kind of conversations, having that, it's like having a mirror held up, and not that she does it. She doesn't do it in that way at all, but it, just through the conversation, the mirror, you know, like, you know, oh gosh, oh, yeah, okay, yeah. Oh, and sometimes I grapple, you know, sometimes I'm like, oh, there's something in that, there's something there for me, I've not quite, and this is why, you know, this is why the course is so important for me to do, because I'm like, especially again going back to my husband, and because it's become, or it is more, it's not more, it's about everything now, but it's in so many areas, but it's so important for me to get obviously this right with my husband and my kids, who are the most important people in my life. And I think there's something there, and it's almost like, you know, you can't quite grab it yet. I think I need to go back to that. I need to re-get this. Yeah. I am in there. I am in that. What you know, you or Layla are talking about. I am in there. There's layers there. Yeah.
There's more stuff there. And that's it, because, so I have some students who will come to my work after doing Layla's book and they want to go deeper. Equally, I've had a few people go the other way around where they completed my course and they're like, okay, now I'm going to do me and white supremacy, so they can just approach it deeper. I don't think the work is ever done, because the more you uncover, the more you will discover. And for me, the work is about curiosity. If we can approach it from curiosity and not shame, then the opportunity to use that information to evolve or better understand yourself or others provides an opportunity that I think you're demonstrating with your relationship with you and Rob. You now have a relationship that was great before, and it's just even more beautiful. So there is opportunity outside of the discomfort. There is opportunity.
Yeah.
I don't know if we're going to have time for this, but I'm going to ask anyway. So you mentioned that you're doing some work in the church. Yeah. I will eventually start speaking about the role on white supremacy and Christianity. I'm not fully there yet, because it is, my God, it's complex, the history. But again, you know, it can't escape it. If we are immersed and have participated into such an enormous infrastructure, industry, where science was based around science, everything, it's going to have fed into religion. Mm-hmm. It's going to have fed into it, and the way we treat people and all sorts of things going on. So how are you, what made you bring this conversation to church? Because many people, there'll be a moral conflict with this. If I'm somebody who is a practicing Christian, who loves all, then how can I possibly be racist? Because I'm morally above that.
Yeah, I don't think about myself as being morally above, and there's a lot of people that, like I said, the general feeling within our church is that we're a work in progress. So most people see themselves as broken, and you know, and I've got their funky stuff that they're dealing with. So I started my relationship with God and Christianity, if you want to call it Christianity, about 7 years ago. And I was quite bounded when I first went in, expecting bigoted and views. And I was sort of thinking if they ever say anything, I'm not going to stay here, I'm going to leave. I'm giving this a go. I'd been invited to go along. I'm giving this a go, and I wanted to. It was something that I was searching for and needing. And so I was very kind of like, okay, let's see what you've got to say. And I remember one of the early ones, one of the pastors getting up and saying, you do know Jesus wouldn't have been white. So he brought that into his service, and I was like, ding. Okay. Yeah. So I kind of got that. But then I did, you know, I noticed that, you know, the leadership is very white, and that we even when we acknowledge that Jesus wasn't white, the resources that come into church, if you're wanting to get church for kids and stuff, the characters are white, and you're like, no, this isn't right. Yeah. So I started sort of bringing this up, and then had a conversation. Had a couple of conversations with my pastor, and he was I said, it's just white men. And he was like, yeah. And he started to, we had these conversations anyway. He's a very, he's an amazing guy. And then he came along to the, you know, the training that I did at work. Because as it happened, our service day that day was being held in my church. It's a warehouse church. And that was just, and so I said to him, because we'd had these couple of conversations, why don't you come along? And he did. Mm. And then he's like, right, I can't unsee it now. And he was following you, and he got Layla's book. Yeah. And he, you know.
I love how your pastor's following me with all my swearing.
Oh, no, he's not. I'm quite worried about that.
But I don't hide, you know, I am who I am. And don't make no mistake, you know, God, whoever it is that you think, you know, that something bigger than us, our faith.
Absolutely.
They see all parts
he's
of
not.
Us. They don't just see the good
absolutely.
Parts.
He's not offended by that. But he's now starting to address this. He's made a statement in church, and then later this week, actually, so there'll be myself, there'll be another guy, a black guy in church, who is actually the husband of the friend that I was recently talking about. We're going to be doing an interview style panel with the pastor on looking at white privilege, and and then he's wanting to sort of address this through leadership, not just in our church, but in other churches that he's connected to. He's really like, it's and I get a great sense. I love to see that. I love to see it happening, something, action being actually taken. So we bought like the brown skin doll for the church nativity, and it's little things like that. There's a tide turning there as well. There's lots of change.
That's very important, because also the church obviously has such influence in this work, so much influence, and just to, you know, to have the courage to role model that curiosity or vulnerability, I think is a great place to start. And, you know, Pastor sounds like a great human. Right, I have two questions, because you and I could talk forever, but sadly, I'm going to have to end at some point. But you, obviously you work in education, and again, that's another industry that needs a lot of help in terms of just bringing this to a conscious level to start with, and then, you know, doing individual work to unpick biases that are impacting outcomes massively for students and young people. And then to start changing what's been taught in terms of the curriculum, so it's, you know, not bloody whitewashed. So my question, it's a big question, but, you know, some of what you mentioned earlier about the talk that you did, and just to give context to readers, it was all about just bringing some of this anti-racism work to awareness of people who are in education and in positions of influence. And I remember us having a chat when sort of COVID first happened about the real risk and fear of those students who are now having to have the GCSE grades predicted, and all of the evidence that shows us that black students often get their grades underpredicted by white teachers. And so, you know, for somebody, you know, for these young people who are going out into the world to try and get jobs, where we have to sadly still work or perform in a way that is putting a lot more effort into being given access to the same opportunities than some of our white peers. So if we're now worried about being underpredicted for GCSEs by people who know us and are biased, what impact is that going to have 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the line? So how have you started to bring these conversations into your workplace as an education psychologist to help?
I did the training, which was looking at the statistics and what was going on in education, as well as talking a little bit around you know, some of the anti-racism things. And I had, and very deliberately, then that's going back to that ally thing, very deliberately had several videos throughout that of black people speaking, so that the platform wasn't, because I didn't want it to be white supremacy in action, me standing up there, or white saviorism, as you mentioned. So I was very definite about that. So I sent people off, and then all this has kind of happened. No, so first of all, yes, COVID. When that happened about the GCSE and A level results, and my heart sank, because I thought, oh gosh, we could lose a whole generation of black and brown kids here. And immediately that thought came, another thought came that meant, people don't want to hear that now, Natalie. You need to not raise that. This is all about, you know, everybody's going through this horrific pandemic. And then almost immediately I had that thought flicked on Instagram, and you'd put, and I was like, right, I am on it. So I sat down, because you'd put this post out, and it had almost matched that. So I was like, right, let's have a look at these statistics. I sent out an email to my principal and I said, this is important. And she sent it back saying, yes, it is. And I was like, brilliant. I was nervous, because I was thinking, am I going to get, Natalie, there's big enough things resistance happening at the minute. We don't need to think about that. But she didn't. So I wrote, as you know, I wrote a short paper, which I wanted it to be short because I wanted people to read it. So it's only two sides. Sent it to my principal, who took it to the head of children's services for Derbyshire, and he took it down to the DfE. Now, I know that I'm a very small cog in a very big wheel, but there was much bigger people talking about this, the Runnymede Trust in particular, who had written directly to Gavin Williamson. But it matters that you do your bit, I think. You see something and you just do your bit. And then that went out onto our bulletins, for the psychology service, so then everybody was kind of aware. And then it all happened, all the Black Lives Matter movement happened, and now, like I said earlier, it has flooded. I've pretty much been taken off the rest of my work in order to just focus on this. It's conversations, it's emails, it's I wrote the CPD bulletin to sort of send people off on the right, you know, on the right track, and again implore them to take on this work, to do the work, and so much so that they actually said, I think we should call the CPD bulletin Black Lives Matter, Do the Work. So they did that, because I must have said it so many times, because I kept saying this, you will see it. If you just do it, you will see it. You'll see what I'm saying. Don't even talk to me anymore about it. Just go and do it, and you will see. And then we can have these different conversations. So as a consequence of that, we're really looking at the way that we work now, and how we raise vulnerable, because we obviously are there to work with vulnerable children and young people. So we work from children from birth to 25 years, young people obviously to 25 years, and we raise, you know, there's children that are at risk of exclusion, children that are looked after, and then you know, sort of putting forward now the idea that we specifically ask about what's happening with the black and brown children in school. Are they out of class more often? Are they in the top tiers? are they proportionately represented? Do you have an idea of, do you feel you've got a good idea of where they are at academically? So all those kind of questions, are their needs been met? And so there's that that's going through as part of a process. Because in actual fact, one of my colleagues found out that there is more children from that have parents in prison than there are looked after children. And when you think about the disproportionate number of black and brown, particularly black people in prison, then this and this that maps exactly onto the disproportionate number of black children that are excluded. 168 times more likely is a black boy than a black girl than a black boy with free school meals and special educational need. So, but the stats are screaming, absolutely screaming, and they have been. They didn't change, actually, from when I did that work in Leeds. The statistics haven't changed.
And what time frame? 15 years.
Yeah.
Wow, yeah. I mean, that's. I'm just going to pause. 15 years. And this is a direct impact of what happens when we spend so much time and energy gathering stats and data. And I'm not saying that the stats and data gathering isn't crucial, but not when it is at the
absolutely
expense of
action. Because and that's the thing changes. At the moment we're seeing a massive reaction, and what we need is a response. And my belief is that you know, drift happens. 15 years of drift happens when you don't stay focused, but shift happens when you are intentional about the small bits of work that you can do every single day. Then gradually over time, in 15 years, we might see something different. And that's why everybody has a part to play. That's why I'm so passionate about everybody having a part to play. No matter who is in your life, it's about humanity, all humanity.
Yes.
And it's and if you care about humanity, so if you're in education and nursing, NHS or coaching or therapy or whatever you're in, you should care about humanity. You can't say you care about humanity until you care about this and all of humanity. Otherwise, you just care about a section. And that's not why we're here. No.
It's not okay. No, it's not okay. Oh, wow. Can I ask you, I know I said I had one question, but I've got two. What do you want to say to call white people, as you refer to them as your people, to call more of them in, because they're listening to this podcast right now.
Do the work. Do the work. You will never regret it. You need to do it. You might not realise just how much you need to do it, but you need to do the work. And the layers and the understanding you'll have for yourself and for humanity is you have no idea of the world that's about to open up to you. It will impact on every part of your life, but most importantly, it's for the freedom and the release from hurt for black and brown people. And that is what is fundamentally the most important part of it. But I just implore them to do it. I'm not saying it's part of the problem. Yeah, you will feel discomfort. You will feel challenge, but that'll pass because it's a bigger picture than that. You're part of the solution, and everybody has got a part to play. Even if the only thing it just shifts the way you buy coffee or think about yourself as you walk down the street, or you know, I'm not expecting everybody to write to Gavin Williamson, but you know, everybody has got something that they can do. Everybody.
And I just want to add something to what you said about, you know, ultimately, you know, that this is about the liberation or the healing for black and brown people and people who experience racism. But equally, there is opportunity, and there is healing that comes for you too as a person who is white, because how you show up in the world, the relationships you start having with other people, with your partner, with your children in every day, like that is the bit that we often forget. It's collective. Anti-racism work is about
absolutely
collective
healing. That's perfect. Yeah, it absolutely is, because I mean, I've sort of been thinking outwardly, but inwardly, yes, it is helping me in other ways. a personal to me, but so not necessarily all the racism side of it. It is helping me in other ways, and it hurts sometimes, you know, especially when I think, did I get that wrong for my daughter? Did I get that wrong for my son? Did I get that wrong for my husband? Yeah, it hurts, but come on, get up, do better. Let's see what we can do now. And it's Maya Angelou's quote is one of my favourite. We did what we knew at the time. When we knew better, we did better. And so there's an element of self-forgiveness there as well, which is hard. I think sometimes it's the hardest to forgive self. I talk about
self-compassion a lot in my online course. It's a huge component because we can't do the work when we're in this blame and shame, like passing, you know, turning it on ourselves. So, okay, beautiful way to end. Very quickly, what's the world you want for your children?
Oh, gosh. A world where they can be their authentic selves and not have to worry about who they bring that authentic self to, not have to judge whether they're in a safe space. And I said this, I had a conversation with Evie several months ago now when she'd been going through something. And I said, you know, Evie, not every white person that you meet is going to really get this stuff. I said, in actual fact, in my life now, I can only think of two people, past and present, that really, really get it. And I said, and with those people, you'll be able to be your most authentic self, but you're going to need to learn to judge that. And somebody asked me about that and said, what did you mean? Because I relayed that conversation to somebody recently, and they said, what did you mean by that? And I said, well, just for her to be able to say, oh my goodness, if somebody else touches my hair, and not be shut down, or, oh, they've chosen another hairstyle that is going to be difficult for me to get my hair into for the dance show, and not to be shut down or not to be dismissed, or, you know, just to be able to just express herself and want them to be safe. I want them to be safe.
I want it
not to be as hard for them as what it's likely to be, and to be free of that stress that comes when you just waiting for the next microaggression.
It's a good place to start. Natalie, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today. Thank you so much for taking out time and just being vulnerable, because I know, you know, this is new territory for you and you dived right on in. And that's what this is all about. So, and also, you know, you are an absolute pleasure to teach. So thank you.
It brings me absolute joy doing this work. Despite the challenge, it brings me absolute joy, and I'm just so grateful that I found you.
Thank you so much.
That's okay.
Wow. Yeah, another interesting, insightful and enriching conversation with Natalie. Wow. I am often asked how I do this work and why I do it. And students like Natalie and Selena Barker, who was in an earlier podcast interview, are examples of the why. People are approaching anti-racism work at different stages of the journey. We also all have our own life, culture, backgrounds that inform how we are able to receive this work or reject it. And why I do this work is for students like Natalie. And if you think about it in terms of any form of self-development, we are much likely to make exponential transformation and change when we're ready to do the work. When we're not clinging on for dear life to the past version of ourselves. And it's not to say that fear doesn't play into that and that we might regret a little bit, or that there isn't conflict along the way, but we are ready to become something bigger and better. We're ready. We're ready for it. We're ready to be vulnerable. We're ready to get it wrong. We're ready to be scared. And when you are in that state, your capacity for change and transformation and impact in this world is huge. And then if you just think the knock-on effects, so the knock-on effect, particularly in this conversation, with how you show up in your relationship with a black man, the knock-on effect on how your daughter looks at you when they see you standing up against racism in a way that you haven't before, the impact in your church, the impact in your workplace. And Natalie has a huge role as somebody who's working in education as an educational psychologist to start to do something about these devastating stats that have been around for decades, and we haven't really seen much improvement because the approach is not being intentional. Being anti-racist means being intentional. When you're intentional, you have more capacity to impact change and affect change and to see things. Like we've talked about in the podcast, it's like seeing the world with a different pair of glasses on. You just have more clarity. It's clearer. You know how to act. You have the tools. You have the language most of the time. And if you don't, you know where to go back and sort of get those. And this is why I talk about the importance of individual self-inquiry, going on this journey as an individual, because we have more opportunities to impact change in our own communities. That then has a knock-on effect. Like Natalie started to talk about her with her pastor, it has a knock-on effect. And that is what the work, that is why I talk about that this work can create a tidal wave of change. We expect this enormous big revolution, but actually the real important work that makes a difference is when each of us take individual responsibility and then collectively we start to see that change. So that's the reason why I do it. I hope you have enjoyed this episode. And if anything is landing and resonating with you and you feel ready to do this work and go on this journey with me and you trust me to support you on that journey, please head over to novareed.com and check out my anti-racism course, which is online and ready to go. It's a pleasure supporting people on this journey to reduce harm and for all of us to become better. And like the role of the teacher and the learner, they're blurred for me. Like I learn so much from my students as much as they learn from me. And it's such a beautiful exchange. And that's why I do this work. And that's what makes it a pleasure when people are ready to become who they were always meant to be. Anyway, that's it from me. Last episode next week. You know what to do. If this podcast has resonated with you, please leave a review on your favorite podcast host. Equally, head on over to my Instagram, Nova Read Official, and let us know what you think. Have a great rest of the week. Take care of you.